Dan Castro will now, from CFA, will now tell us about the expansion and width of the synchrotron filaments associated with the forward shock of CASA.
So, hello everyone. Thank you very much for being here. I got the sweet spot of the last long talk of the day, right after you're extremely tired of hearing about CASA and non-thermal filaments. But the good part is that my intro is going to go a lot faster because you've heard quite a bit of it already. So I'm going to be talking about what Rob called yesterday the ECPC part of CASA, which is the forward shock. Specifically, as we observe it with Chandra since 2000. Hold on 1 second. This is not advancing though. And real quick, here are my collaborators who are going to come into really collaborate into this more on the interpretation side, which is going to kick on soon since this is definitely work in progress right now. Specifically, I want to highlight Dan and Jaco, who have helped me working with this amazing data set, which is, I have to say, the most amazing data set I've ever worked with in my entire life, 18 years. Of long observations of this amazing remnant. Right, so a quick outline. Why should you care about the connection between supernova remnants and cosmic rays? Thankfully, Aya and many other speakers during this session have already talked about that, so we're really going to skip over that real fast. Also, what evidence we've gathered up to now that supernova remnants indeed accelerate cosmic rays. But we're going to concentrate on the bit that is really interesting to you guys today, which is the results from this multi-year study of CASA. Right, so why is it important to study cosmic rays and supernova remnants and their connection, both for cosmic ray acceleration and for supernova remnant science itself? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. We want to know what the origin of cosmic rays. We want to understand the gamma ray background. We want to understand how particle acceleration at shocks works, and supernova remnants are a great candidate for that. La-di-la-di-la. Supernova remnant evolution, as Aya pointed out earlier, is really important to understand cosmic ray acceleration if you want to study how supernova remnants evolve, because a bunch of the energy is being put into cosmic rays and it's escaping the system. So clearly, it's not just a nice confined system as one would have if you didn't have cosmic rays being accelerated. And finally, cosmic ray feedback turns out to be a very important element in galaxy evolution, et cetera. So if you really care about galactic evolution, you need to care about how cosmic rays are accelerated, where they're accelerated, and how they propagate away from those sites. Now, the evidence that we've gathered up to now, this is just a personal quick list. Some work has been done on the shock structure, sort of the sort of different positions of the forward shock relative to the reverse shock, and trying to compare that to systems where no energy is being lost by accelerating cosmic rays, and it turns out that in some remnants, such as Tycho, we can actually pinpoint that a large fraction of the energy, in the order of 10% of the total explosion energy, has gone into accelerating particles to relativistic energies. Secondly, what we're going to concentrate today on is non-thermal X-rays, and they've already talked quite a bit about how synchrotron emission is telling us that there are TeV electrons in there and how they emit. But also, coming from the non-thermal X-ray part and from the synchrotron emission itself, we can actually measure that the magnetic field seems to have been amplified. And the way we understand magnetic field amplification best is if it's caused by this very same cosmic rays, which are the ones doing the emitting as well. So basically, significant magnetic field amplification is a result of cosmic ray acceleration efficiently in shocks. So if we see that, then we have a real good clue that shocks are indeed accelerating particles to relativistic energies. And then finally, gamma ray emission, and there's, you know, this entire debate between what we see is leptonic emission from remnants or hadronic emissions from remnants. And if you've been to talks by me before, many of my talks concentrate on trying to sort of tell those two emission mechanisms apart. Going back to the MFA, since that's what I'm going to be talking about, well, what my results point towards in this talk today about, I'm going to sort of mention a couple of ways in which we've detected that the magnetic field has been amplified in remnants. One of them is by studying the variability in synchrotron emission from certain remnants. And this down here is a bit from the Uchiyama et al. Paper in 2007, which shows RxJ1713 and nuggets of synchrotron emission that seem to disappear in timescales of a year or so. And basically, the magnetic field strength that you derive from the synchrotron timescale of those observations is somewhere around 1 milligauss. So you're talking about, you know, a local a magnetic field strength that should be roughly 2 to 3 microgauss, and then the post-shock magnetic field sort of it's pointing towards something much amplified in terms of the, in relation to that. So the motivation for our study is very simple. We want to study the connection between shock characteristics and particle acceleration, specifically using this amazing data set, which has been gathered for CASA for the last 18 years. So again, as I mentioned before, evidence for magnetic field amplification, the rapid variability that we observe in certain remnants, and also the thinness of the X-ray filaments that we observe around remnants. And this is some nice figures from Aya's paper in 2005, where she derived the sort of filament width for several different filaments in several different remnants. Here's Tycho, Kepler, and Cassé. And she derived that these remnants, that these filaments were extremely, extremely thin. And if you consider that the thinness or the width of the filament is connected to the magnetic field that is making this electrons lose their energy very quickly as they move away from the acceleration site, then basically the thinner your filament is, the stronger your magnetic field is. Okay, so the data set that we use for this study is 20 years of Chandra observations. It's a little bit exaggerated. You know, it's 20 years up to today, but really I used up to observations in 2018. The largest total exposure I use is sort of a summed up of 165 kiloseconds. This is a program by Una Huang in 2004. And I only used that small fraction of the entire exposure because it's the bit where the PSF was roughly constant in the same region. And for what I'm going to show you, it actually makes life a lot easier. So the method we use is we set the data to be just photons that arrive between 4.2 and 6 keV, which is definitely continuum dominated. And in the forward shock region, again, the ECPC part, this is really believed to be mostly synchrotron emission and not any of the thermal continuum. Now, I'm showing you a nice movie of how the remnant has evolved since 2000. And here we're just going to concentrate in one filament in the southeast, so that you can actually definitely see it moving forward. Which to me is just amazing because it's just incredible to see something move across in the sky from, you know, that far away, especially in synchrotron X-rays, not just in X-rays. Again, I would like to highlight that this is the type of science that can only be done with Chandra today because of Chandra's exquisite resolution. So what we do is we grab a very long band, and then we divide it into little thin boxes, and we extract the count rate in each of those boxes as you move radially away. For example, in this case, I'm considering this filament right here, and you might think, well, why is he extracting all this data all the way out here? It's because I'm interested in also detecting where the CCO is located in that profile, so that I can use the CCO in order to register the image. I don't have any point sources that I can register the image with, so I use positions of the shock relative to the central compact object. Now, the central compact object seems to be moving roughly by southeast. So this might introduce a small variation in the shock velocities that are derived, since the CCO is actually moving in the sky as well. But it's moving a lot slower than the shock is. So it doesn't actually turn out to be all that important. Now, what does a profile like that look like? So this is for that same little rim, 32. That's in 2004. That's the CCO. That's the forward shock. And I've actually already overlaid the 2018 rim. And you can see how far it's already moved here in the forward shock. The CCO doesn't seem to have moved. And this spikes over here, which are actually fairly coincident, is this bright knot here, which belongs to the reverse shock. So what we do is we fit them with a method that I stole from IES paper a long time ago, which is basically you fit it with two different exponentials, one for the downstream part and one for the upstream part. And then you can derive, by this method, you can derive basically how much it's moved in time, and also how thin or how wide your filaments are downstream and upstream. But I'm going to concentrate on downstream results today. Now, for RIM 32, this is the position of the forward shock in time. And then basically, you can actually derive just the velocity from just fitting this with a straight line. If you fit it with a set of solution, is basically undistinguishable in a plot like this right now. So we can just fit it with a straight line. You can also derive the rim width. And in this case, I'm also overplotting in as a histogram what the PSF of Chandra was at the position of that specific rim when the observation was taken, so that, for example, these points are within the PSF, so we can't really tell. That becomes basically an upper value. So this one is a really funky one that I'm showing you, because you can actually see the width is actually narrowing with time. So I don't want you to concentrate too much on that, because this is the only rim that actually shows that. Most other rims look something like this. So your data, most of the data you have to actually cut out, and then you just fit it with a straight line in between, just like that. And you repeated that for 15 different rims for 13 observations, which gives you something like 200 profiles to fit, which was great fun. And then a sexy table to show you, which is how everyone wants to see the results, but not really. What I'm showing you here is basically the positions of the two rims that are at the edges of the distribution in velocity. The fastest one was something about 7,000 kilometers per second, plus or minus 700. And then the slowest one was around 4,000 kilometers per second, also plus or minus 900. But there's some velocities that are actually a little bit better in terms of the uncertainty that we get. Now, in order to see that well, I'm going to show it to you like this. This is so the arrows represent, the length of each of these arrows represents the velocity of the shock. The fastest one that I showed you just now is this bit over here, which is to the west, which people might find a little bit surprising, since we were just hearing about some dense stuff that is going to stop the shock and sort of is pushing into the ejecta on this side of the remnant. And then the slowest one seems to be this one over here, which again, it's kind of curious that it seems to be roughly aligned with what is called the sort of the northeastern jet. Yes, so, and the widths seem to be proportional to the velocity. Now, this was a little surprising to me again, especially if you consider, the width of the filament should be inversely proportional to the magnetic field strength, but it depends on whether the width is being given by the advection of your non-relativistic electrons away from the shock front, or from diffusion away from the shock front, is relation to the velocity of the shock, right? So if it's due to advection, the faster your shock is moving, the wider your filament is going to be. But if it's due to diffusion, it is actually inversely proportional to the velocity. Now, the magnetic fields that that you can glimpse at by using the widths that we've derived, they vary between 200 and 900 microgauss. So again, fairly amplified in comparison to the local interstellar magnetic field strength. So they vary from one position to the other. So this shouldn't be taken as definitely evidence that this is advection length that is being that we're measuring here, rather than the diffusion length. But again, it sort of points in that direction. So the takeaways that I want you to take home with you are there are very large variations in the forward shock velocity of gas A, somewhere between, as I said, 4,000 and 7,000 kilometers per second. The width of the synchrotron filaments in gas A seems to be correlated to the velocity of each of these rims. And a more cavalier statement, which I won't go into too much today, is that for a couple of rims, it seemed like the width of the filament was narrowing in time. And it was narrowing in time significantly. The one that I showed you before, rim 32, went from basically 4 arc seconds in size to about 1 arc second in size. A factor of 4 in change of the filament width. If we put that straight into those length equations, they relate to a change in the magnetic field of a factor of 2.5. So that would be an extreme change in the magnetic field strength in 18 years, which would be quite remarkable. So we need to do a little bit more work on that. And finally, right before I leave the stage, I just want to point out that it's been 20 years since Chandra's launch. This science that I just showed you can only be done with this amazing telescope. And one of its first light images was of Cas A. And here I'm comparing what Einstein used to see before Chandra was launched and what we can now see with Chandra in its first light image. So, help us celebrate Chandra. There's a science symposium in December in Boston. And you're all welcome to come. It would be great to see you all there. And there's more information on that at the CXC website. And I'm just going to leave it at that if you have any questions.
Yeah, we have time for a question or two. That's Rob again.
Just a quick comment. It's not so crazy to find the lowest velocity near the northeast part, because it looks there's evidence that Cassay's running into more material, CSM material, diffuse CSM material, to the northeast and less to the southwest, which is just what you see.
That's exactly what I see, yeah.
So you show the position of the rim 32.
Yeah.
As a function of time, and then the shock velocity is constant during the observational period.
Yes.
But what about the other rims?
So most of the other rims, the velocity seems to also be constant.
Constant.
I was really trying to tease out a deceleration in many of them, but I couldn't actually find a significant signal for it. Some of them seem to find it, but the error bars are a little too large to say that that's actually a significant finding. It might take a few more years in order for us to really chunk it into, say, 10-year periods and see how the velocity varied in 10-year chunks. But
even in western region, the shock velocity is constant.
Yeah, I was not able to find a significant deceleration or acceleration in any of the 15 rims that I studied.
So one more while we're... While that's going on, if we could, the poster snapshot people could assemble, please. Okay, yes.
So this is a general question, but Dan, you can answer it. These are pretty extreme variations in velocity from point to point. So is the implication that this big change in velocity, I mean, it's basically circular, right, the outer edge. So is the implication that some of these decelerations or changes in velocity have happened very recently? from 7,000 to 4,000 kilometers per second, you wouldn't have a circular remnant if there that or it would be a lot more chaotic on the edge.
Yeah. So definitely, I mean that's a fairly good argument considering that most of the filaments that I'm actually talking about are roughly at the same radius. So you're right. It's a little surprising that they're moving at such a different speeds. But again, if we're talking about the remnant or the shock actually just encountering the edge of this bubble in certain regions or certain over densities in certain regions, then that's the type of thing that would result in that. For example, what Rob just pointed out, that it seems to be hitting some CSM over here and less dense stuff over here would actually make sense.
Okay, one quick last question, I guess.
Possibly say optical or
So the question was how does the comparison of the velocity dispersion, how does it compare to other wave bands? And I haven't actually looked. The honest answer is future work.
Okay, I think it's time to move on to the posters. Thank you again.